From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. It wasn't easy for the heavy metal band Akrasakauda to play their music under Saddam Hussein, but things got worse after the U.S. invasion. The members of the band were forced to flee Iraq after getting death threats from insurgents. They now live in the U.S. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk with the band's lead singer Faisal Talal and drummer Marwan Riyad. And we'll hear from Sarush Alvi, the co-director of Heavy Metal in Baghdad, a documentary about the band. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the latest album by Drive-By Truckers, in which they chronicle small-town life. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Clash of the Titans, the 3D remake of the 1981 cult classic. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Baghdad wasn't the easiest place to keep a heavy metal band together. Metal wasn't exactly the preferred music of the Saddam Hussein regime, but for the musicians on today's show, things got a lot worse after the U.S. invasion. The insurgency started, then soon after they got death threats from Islamist insurgents. Even wearing a Metallica t-shirt could put your life at risk. The documentary Heavy Metal in Baghdad is about one of the first and one of the few bands to perform heavy metal in Baghdad. The group is called Akrasakauda, which is Latin for Black Scorpion. The movie was shot in 2005 and 6 in Baghdad. It also follows the musicians after they crossed the border into Syria when the death threats became too much for them. You can find a link to watch the film online at nprmusic.org. It's also available on DVD. And last month, the band released their first ever recording. Today we'll listen to Terry's 2009 interview with two members of the band, drummer Marwan Riyad and lead singer and rhythm guitarist Faisal Talal. They're joined in the interview by the co-director and producer of the documentary, Sharoush Alvi, who co-founded Vice Magazine Publishing. After making the film, he helped relocate the band members to the United States. Before we hear the band's story, let's hear what they sound like. This is the song Garden of Stones from their new recording, Only the Dead See the End of the War.
The life you read once had a name. The blood stains your hands, wrapped in guilty shame. I grieve for what turns to ashes and bones, buried beneath the garden of stones.
That's music from the Iraqi heavy metal band Akrasakauda, and welcome Marwan Riyad, Faisal Talal, and Sharoush Alvi. Tell us what first got you interested in heavy metal music, which there probably wasn't a whole lot of in Baghdad. Faisal, you want to start?
Yeah, sure. We basically loved foreign music, so heavy metal was the road to us to explain more of our feelings, explode that kind of rage inside us, and try to find its way, dig its way, you know. But that wasn't enough for us as fans or listeners only. So, but basically, we turned our horses to more educational and more training as a band. Try to feel this music more and more.
Marwan, was it hard to find heavy metal records in Baghdad? I'm sure there weren't a lot of, maybe there were, record shops that had big heavy metal and death metal sections in it.
Well, we don't want to, be a bad influence or something, but there was, a lot of bootlegs, and that was a good stuff, cheap stuff.
And did the bootlegs have the covers on them and everything?
Well, sometimes, no, you don't get lucky, with the cover. So what we used to do is just, write the stuff down on paper and just, put it with the tape. I mean, we didn't have CDs. We had the tapes, cassettes, and or somebody, will travel outside Iraq and come back with, a collection of stuff, heavy metal, rock and roll, Dio and Black Sabbath and stuff like that. And we'll just copy them and this is the way that we just trade between each other. And sometimes by the time that you get the tape, you can't really listen to a good quality. It will be but still good. You still can headbang to it.
Let me ask you to talk about a song that you recorded after you left Iraq and lived in Syria briefly, and you were able to make a demo record in Syria. And one of the songs you made was called Massacre. It starts out in Arabic. Would you explain what's being said at the beginning of this recording?
Well, what's been said is about the innocent people getting killed, rivers turning to blood, since we had two rivers in Iraq and stuff. And it has nothing to do just about the images that we have to live daily in our lives, you know. Sometimes something bad happens in your life that you can't just get over it, you know. You'll dream about it, you'll think about it the whole time, you know. So we're just trying to get this off our backs by hopefully, if we do that, these songs, mostly as a tribute for the people who just, got killed or whatever in the war. So we're saying, like, you know, basically, like, you know, these innocent children, innocent people, elders and seniors, like, who got killed. And some people, like, a lot of people got killed in vain, you know.
منذ أعوام مضت تدعو أسلوبا جديدا بقتل الأبرياء الأطفال الشيوخ والنساء قنابل تسقط كالمطر من السماء امتلأت الأنهار بدماء الأبرياء
And the devil is still waiting down. And what a death, rest the future. The same as yours, even much more than they want to want. And what a truth, and all you got, you gotta kill that beast.
It's a trade of revolution.
That's the song Massacre by the Iraqi heavy metal band Across the Kauda. And the members of the band are now living in the United States. Two of the members are my guests, Marwan Rayad, who's the drummer, and Faisal Talal, who's the rhythm guitarist and singer. Also with us is one of the two filmmakers, Sarush Alvi. Let's talk about what it was like to play heavy metal in Baghdad before the American invasion. Let's start with the Saddam Hussein era. Did the government disapprove of heavy metal music? Did you have to play it underground?
This is Faisal. Basically, the government didn't disapprove anything back in the time. Most of the rumors come ahead from old friends and the people who surround us, because we had to translate all the lyrics that we used to sing, just in case, and be prepared that somebody would ask us or tell us that what the hell that we're writing about, or describe that the music that you're expressing.
I mean, no. I think I'm going to jump in here. And
go ahead.
I think
this
you
is
guys should talk
Sarush,
about
the filmmaker.
Sarush. They wrote a song called "Youth of Iraq" that they don't like talking about, and I'm going to force them to talk about it.
Dude.
Oh, I was going to ask you about this. Yeah, this is a song that you. It's explained in the movie that when you did a concert under Saddam Hussein, you had to do a tribute to Saddam, a musical tribute to Saddam. So you did one. That's in the movie.
It was an opening for a concert. Thanks, Sarush.
It's their dirty little secret. They don't like talking about it, but it's in the movie. So.
You're evil. You know that.
Just to make it more evil, let me quote one of the lines from the song.
Yeah, sure. Be my guest.
Right, okay. And this is about fighting the evil forces. And the line is, "We're following our leader, Saddam Hussein. We'll make them fall. We'll drive them insane."
Yippee.
So did you?
I love that song.
Did you write that just for this concert, so that you could have your shout out to Saddam Hussein, or did you change the lyric of a pre-existing song?
No. Actually, like, the whole thing is, like, just like Faisal said before, it's just through, like, our friends who, like, had bands before, like, played gigs. We're kind of, like, intimidated by the situation down there, so we're kind of frightened because it's the first concert. So they told us, like, you know, maybe we should take precautions and just, like, you know, write something to the government. Some of us, like, you know, proved, some of us disproved the whole thing. But I guess the song came to be, and we played it twice in two concerts. Then we quit playing it. I guess it's much more like, you know, in order, like, you know, to play your music, you gotta do some stuff that probably you need to be flexible. You need to go with the flow, which is not good all the time, but we had to do it.
Well, since there's a scene of you performing it in the film about you, Heavy Metal in Baghdad, why don't we listen to an excerpt of that performance, of your tribute to Saddam Hussein. And what's the song called again?
Youth of Iraq.
Youth of Iraq, wow. Okay, here it is. And this is the band Across the Kauda.
Across the Kauda.
is the band Across Akauta. They're an Iraqi heavy metal band that managed to get out of Iraq, and the band members are now living in the United States. My guests are two members of the band, Marwan Rayad and Faisal Talal. My third guest, Sarush Alvi, is the co-director of a documentary about the band. The film is called Heavy Metal in Baghdad. So we were talking a little bit about playing in a heavy metal band while Saddam Hussein was in power. Let's talk about what it was like after the American invasion, when there was a civil war, and a lot of the insurgents were ultra-religious Muslims, many of whom like didn't even like music, let alone heavy metal music. So and Americans were really hated by, or maybe I should say are really hated by, a lot of Iraqis, and heavy metal is so associated with American bands and with American popular culture. So did all of that, did the religious fundamentalism and the hatred of America affect your ability to play heavy metal music, or even to wear your favorite T-shirts?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, totally. I mean, it was already like dangerous, like forbidden, like to play such kind of music. I wouldn't say forbidden, but was just like just too eccentric, you know. But of course, after the invasion, became a matter of life and death. And does it really worth it? Does it even worth it that you're playing music and you're threatening, you're jeopardizing your life and your family too with that, you know?
Was it so dangerous? I mean, I know it was dangerous just to be outside, no matter who you were, but why was it particularly dangerous?
Well, it's first, we're singing like in English, mm-hmm. you know? So they considered that like Americanized. Second, it's rock and roll, so that's also Americanized, you know? Third, it's like, you know, the way that we dress, the way that they can see us coming back and forth from the practice space. And you know, well, obviously we wouldn't like, you know, we weren't like going to the practice space wearing mihrab or something or turbans, you know. So it was kind of like, you know, we were kind of distinguished, but in a bad way. So that's the thing. So we received the threats that we're Americanized.
So how would the threats be delivered? Like, would someone tell you, we're going to kill you if you keep playing your music? I mean, how?
Well, you know, we found them hanging on the store walls, like, you know, the front door for the
practice space.
Yeah, practice space. We found them there.
Right.
And it was like pieces of papers and, you know, written and just hanged there.
We'll hear more from two members of the Iraqi heavy metal band Across Akauta and the co-director of a documentary about them after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to Terry's 2009 interview with two members of the Iraqi heavy metal band Across Akauta, drummer Marwan Rayad and lead singer and rhythm guitarist Faisal Talal. Joining them is Sarush Alvi, the co-director of a documentary about the band called Heavy Metal in Baghdad.
Sarush, you and your co-director helped organize a concert for the band at the Al-Fanar Hotel in Iraq. So there's scenes of this concert in the movie. And the audience, I mean, it's a relatively small audience because it's what, like in the ballroom of the hotel or something.
Yeah.
But people are so into it, and everybody's kind of, you know, like doing the headbanging thing and making this, you know, kind of like falling on each other, and I mean, doing the devil horns. They're so into it. But from what I could see, there wasn't one female in the audience. So I was wondering, is it because the music didn't appeal to women, or is it because women just couldn't go out then? Or, I mean, like, what accounts for the fact that there were no females?
It was too dangerous.
Too dangerous?
Them. Yeah. Basically, the whole tradition wasn't, like, so acceptable for women to walk alone in the street or having boyfriends or something, just, like, not so liberated. Neither say that going to a dangerous spot that we performed at that night, which is basically it's near to the Sheraton and Palestine Hotel, which has been surrounded by concrete blocks and Americans all over the place and the whole security guards. So they check the whole Iraqi IDs and search the whole T-shirts, scanning machines, and all that stuff. So an Iraqi woman wouldn't bother to go through all that process just to see heavy metal. I mean, yes, they do exist. A lot of listeners. I mean, I got for now. I mean, I'm having a lot of messages on MySpace or Facebook or whatever, they're just expressing their feeling that they wish to come at these concerts, but they couldn't, and they wish they could seen us before. So at this point, I feel glad about it, you know, just like all these years, I was imagining there's no scene of metal to women, you know. But now, just like everyone started coming up, and now it's really growing.
It's funny because, you know, certainly in the United States, so many musicians say they became musicians because they thought they would be more appealing to girls if they were in a band.
Sex and drugs and
no, exactly, and exactly. And of course, here you are in Iraq, where like girls can't even show up to the concert, so it's not going to be very helpful in that area.
It's more like, you know, bomb and war and rock and roll for us.
Yeah, no, exactly, exactly.
I guess.
You said for you it was like war bombs and rock and roll. In this concert that we've been talking about, there's a power outage. There was a mortar that goes off like next door or something. So. So
it's part of the scene, actually, just like fireworks, you know. So it's much easier to do such stuff in Iraq.
You did kind of get used to it in a way, didn't you? I mean, you seemed kind of like unfazed by it in the movie.
No, I guess it's all going to be overrated if we say, like, we got used to it. No, you can never get used to such a stuff. Like, bombs, I don't think nobody can get used to it. But you just, like, you know, it's part of, like, basic human survival, I guess. You have to survive, you know? So you have to go, like, wake up every day and you have to go to work every day. And, you know, you can't starve. So you can't get used to it. But you can deal with it, I guess.
So eventually, you and the other members of the band decided to do your best to get out of Iraq. Two members went first, the other two followed. Can you tell us why you wanted to leave and how difficult it was to get out? You went to Syria first.
Let me just rephrase this before.
The
general idea of us leaving Iraq is not like because we wanted that so desperately. I mean, most of people could miss it or misunderstand it, but we've been forced to leave. And leaving all this behind was so hard. It was so depressing for us. We wanted to do something for the band. And for me, I mean, at my time when I wanted to leave, I had already two members of my band had already left to Syria.
How long were you in Syria and how long were you in Turkey?
Well, a year and a half, I guess like 3 years overall. I can't be exact, but I guess it's overall like 3 years together.
Did it feel like freedom in either of the places, or were you in such difficult positions that you still didn't really feel?
Well, you need to understand we're refugees, so it's life like just, it's a hard life multiplied like in 10 times, I guess, like because a lot of bureaucratic stuff that you need to go through, paperwork, just to legalize your situation and just to, you know. A lot of people got the bliss, like, you know, to born in their countries and walk tall and stuff. For us, it was, even that was kind of hard. So we had to go, like, through down streets and alleys just to avoid, like, being in like, misunderstanding situation or get caught by the police because sometimes we're illegal in these places because the paperwork wasn't done.
Well, I guess the general idea wouldn't, I mean, things was getting really harder and harder, and we were out of time, out of money, so we had to do what we had to do.
And what did you have to do because you were out of money?
We made heavy metal in Baghdad.
Yay.
We said yes to whatever solution any.
You hadn't said yes before that?
I don't know.
Not in our Baghdad, you know.
I think it took some time to gain the trust of these guys as well and the whole, you know, process of making the film. But once the film was out and premiering at the Toronto Film Festival, that's when the Syrian government was getting fed up with, you know, the number of Iraqis that were coming in, were threatening to kick Iraqis back in to Iraq. And at that time, the guys were receiving threats from inside of Iraq when they were living in Syria. So because of the footage that we'd shot and put on our website on vbs.tv, I'm not sure if that makes sense, but what happened was that we had kind of outed these guys. They're living their lives as refugees in Syria, and all of a sudden they're getting threats for their music from inside of Iraq, people saying, you know, come back home, we'll take care of you, meet us on this corner at this time in this city. So the guys are contacting us saying, Syrian government's about to kick us back home, and going back home is a really bad idea. What can we do?
The situation wasn't stable, too.
Yeah, yeah. So that's when we started raising money.
Raising money to get them out of Syria?
To get them out of Syria and get them to Turkey. Turkey was the one country that you could fly to as an Iraqi without a visa, and they would accept you. That was the one border that was kind of open at that time, and even that had a window that was going to close. So we hustled and, you know, raised awareness, and the metal community donated.
That was the craziest thing ever. Yeah.
Yeah, donated, you know, whatever, 25 grand or something like that. And with that, we got them tickets and some cash in their pockets when they landed.
Marwan Riyad and Faisal Talal of the Iraqi metal band Across Akata will be back in the second half of the show, along with Saroosh Alvi, who made the documentary Heavy Metal in Baghdad. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Booz Allen Hamilton, strategy and technology consultants at boozallen.com/ready for what's next. From HDA, on behalf of state agencies working to make the business case for employing people with disabilities, learn more at thinkbeyondthelabel.com. And from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Drive-By Truckers. He says it's a fitting addition to their impressive body of work. David Edelstein reviews Clash of the Titans, the 3D remake of the 1981 cult classic, and more with the members of the Iraqi band Across Akata. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today we're hearing about what it was like to be a heavy metal band in Baghdad. We're listening to Terry's 2009 interview with two members of the Iraqi metal band Across Akata, drummer Marwan Riyad and lead singer and rhythm guitarist Faisal Talal. The band's the subject of the documentary Heavy Metal in Baghdad. Joining them is the film's co-director Saroosh Alvi. After the insurgency started, the band started getting death threats from Islamist insurgents. When we left off, they were talking about leaving Iraq and living as refugees in Syria and Turkey before they made it to the United States.
So, now, Turkey isn't the end of the story. Saroosh, you helped get them with the contributions from the heavy metal community. You helped get them into Turkey. But now you guys are living in the United States. Was Turkey a problem eventually, too?
No, we need a place. Okay, we couldn't stay like in exile forever. We couldn't stay like in stable forever. Mm-hmm. We couldn't like walk and we're carrying like the forms of refugees, like 3-4 papers around, you know. You need to understand it's refugee. Being a refugee is not a status. It's just like, you know, form. You know, it's part of a process, you know. And that's why that it was just like, you know, it wasn't the destination. So we had to go to some place where we can perform our music, where we can play our music. It didn't matter where, just like, you know, we had to find a solution. And I remember we applied, like, with help from the Vice, we applied to the Canadian embassy twice, got rejected, and the German, because, like, embassy were, they were premiering Heavy Metal in Baghdad, the movie, and they helped a lot, but just the papers, I guess it was a problem with our paperwork. Then it just happens that we got to the States and you know, and it took a while. We came to here, like, separately, you know.
The level of bureaucracy, as an outsider, looking in, seeing what these guys had to go through in Turkey was totally insane. The psychological impact that this amount of bureaucracy has on refugees, it really takes its toll. And the system on some level doesn't make sense. They, even once they became, you know, official refugees in Turkey, they weren't allowed to work legally. And then were forced to resettle in these satellite cities all over Turkey. So the band was then broken up, and they're all living in 4 different cities inside of Turkey, and they have to check in with the local police stations every week for, you know, X number of months until they can be granted exit visas out of the country.
Yeah, until they finish the process.
Because Turkey doesn't want Iraqis to stay there indefinitely. It was kind of like a temporary station. They want to resettle the refugees in another country, and so that's why, you know, we got the IRC involved, who are the International Rescue Committee. They're an NGO based here in New York, who got behind their cases and helped expedite everything and got them resettled
in the United States
the last couple of months.
So you're all living in New Jersey now.
No, we're just separated. Some in New York, some in Michigan, some in New Jersey. Also scattered again.
Oh, but I didn't realize that. So one member of your band is in Michigan?
Yeah, for now. Yeah. I mean, like, just because we can't afford, like, you know. I mean, the crisis of the economy a little bit affecting us.
So you finally made it to America. So what are you doing to make a living and to pay your rent?
Working different jobs, waiting tables. Mm-hmm. And whatever, you know, overtime jobs. But, you know, you need to understand the main reason for us is the music to be here. Working with the Vice on finding something and solutions. But everything's taken, like, you know, a while, you know, finding instruments, finding practice space.
Finding instruments. You know. Did you not have your instruments when you came?
Oh, we had to sell them all so we can afford, like, you know, whatever, tickets, pocket, like, money for our pockets and stuff. So we had to sell our instruments.
Do you have them back yet?
Some of the, you know, companies out there like Fender Guitars have been really supportive in the past, and Yamaha just gave a bass to Faraz, and, you know, James Hetfield gave his guitar to Faisal.
This is James Hetfield of Metallica, and if you want to see him giving the guitar to Faisal, just go on YouTube. Because it's on there. It's a really sweet moment.
Yeah, for those who doesn't still concerning about the whole situation, I'm still in coma, okay? I'm still in coma. Yes.
So have you been to any heavy metal concerts in the United States? I know you can't afford food, but have you managed to get into any concerts?
Yeah, I mean, like, we can't afford tickets, but, you know, the Vice is helping, kind of, like, getting us, like, mooching tickets.
So talk a little bit about the experience of being in a heavy metal concert in the United States compared to what you were used to.
It's great seeing the amount of people, and on the whole benches are full, and people standing, and people going through the mosh pits and the stuff. I mean, you don't see that every day, like, for us, you know? And it's great seeing, like, a big community of metal heads and metal fans and standing on that solid ground, and the bands performing. And it was a great show. I mean, like, it was kind of like an epiphany for us, like, to see all these stuff. And just to remind us about what we're kind of miss the most, which is music and perform on stage. I mean, like, we had 600 people on stage and we were like, you know, yeah, we had 600 people on stage and yeah, whatever, you know, and now, like, I just go to an underground concert and there's like, you know, 1,000 like of people and watching like an underground band. So it's great. I mean, like, we're kind of being optimistic considering the music, trying to work hard just to catch up, because it's been the last 2 years. I mean, like, we didn't really, you know, continue with our music because we had to handle all the paperwork and just like we said, the bureaucracy stuff.
So I'm sure you'd love to be in that position of being on stage in America with thousands of fans in the audience.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. Just all over the globe. You know?
Just like when I was trying to talk to the guy and tell them, just like, guys, seriously, for the first time, we're fit in the whole society. I mean, the whole guys was metalheads and headbangers and all these hot chicks and around you. And all. So just like was really, really interesting to see all that, you know, just like, yes, I want this.
But here's the thing, like, now you finally fit into this large community of fellow heavy metal fans and musicians, but you're still the outsider because now you're an Iraqi in this American community. So, like, you're finally with your people, but they're not quite your people.
See, to be honest, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. For these people, like, you know, music does matter.
Mm-hmm.
Paperwork and that says, like, where you're from and stuff. I'm like, we speak the same language. We speak the language of the music, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it sounds kind of like cheesy or cliche, but this is the way it is.
Right.
We went to this festival in Atlanta, and there was like 31 bands performing. And we were like surprised to see how much people knew about us and knew about the movie. But they knew about us, and they were like, you know, really delighted and with, like, you know, wide or open arms saying, like, you know, we want to take photos with you guys. Are you playing today? So I don't think it does matter. Borders and frontiers and stuff doesn't matter. It doesn't make sense in the music, like, world, you know?
I'm interested in how you feel about America now. Here's what I'm thinking. You know, the American government decided it wanted to, like, you know, bring democracy to Baghdad and ended up bringing civil war to Iraq. And you became victims of that. You had to flee the country because of it. So that might go in the negative column for you, for America. And part of the reason why you had to flee is because you were playing a music that came out of America, heavy metal, and America was so hated in Iraq then that you were threatened. And now you're living in America. At the same time, you're broke. It was hard to get in here. It's not like America invited you to come. I mean, it was really hard for you to get in.
I already feel better when you say, like, the whole story, you know? Like, you're, like, reminding me of this, and it feels good.
So, but how do you feel about America now? I mean, like, what are your thoughts about the country?
It's not easy. It's not easy as it seems. It's a lot more complicated if you want to, like, just, like, you know, and one program or show, like, trying to describe, like, two nations' policies and politically views, and you know, you can't do that. First, like, we're musicians. And second, I guess what happens in a lot of points was monstrous, and you can't justify it, you know. But also we can't justify, like, the First World War or, like, the second one or, like, you know, all over. I can't justify the goal for or trying to analyze it or explain it, because, you know, we had our head in the music. But I would say, like, you know, killing living souls and stuff, that's wrong, you know, and this is against everything, and we had to go through that and we had to live through that, and I guess we got lucky in a way, you know, if you look at it. A lot of people got killed in these wars, and a lot of people just, you know, had to live with a lot of, like, you know, living like the daily sorrow of missing someone or, you know, part of their families,
even
part
here,
of their lives.
Even here, a lot of families lost their own kids and sons and daughters in the army, I mean, over there. Just like, it isn't fair, you know. Both societies been destroyed.
Well, that's what we're saying. Like, we can't justify war. I mean, like, if you expect, like, two musicians just to come and talk about war, like, you know, I wouldn't like drag myself to that. Yeah, but I, but I would say it's monstrous, it's hideous, and we don't want to sound hippies, but you know, wish there was peace on earth, but I don't think this is possible.
Well, Marwan and Faisal, I want to wish you good luck with your lives and with your music. And Sarush, congratulations on the movie, and thank you for talking with us. It's been a pleasure to talk with the three of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Marwan Riad and Faisal Talal are members of the Iraqi metal band Across Akauda. Sarush Alvi is the co-director of a documentary about the band called Heavy Metal in Baghdad. The band has been reunited on the East Coast, and they're playing Monday night at the Lit Lounge in New York. They also have a new recording called Only the Dead See the End of the War. You can download one of the tracks of the new recording at nprmusic.org, where you can also find a link to watch Heavy Metal in Baghdad online. It's also available on DVD. Coming up, Ken Tucker on the new album from Drive-By Truckers. This is Fresh Air. Drive-By Truckers is a band formed in the late 90s in Athens, Georgia, by guitarists and singer-songwriters Patterson Hood and Mike Cooley. They had a critical success with the band's 2001 release Southern Rock Opera, which suggested their ambition and a penchant for narrative detail. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the band's new album, called The Big To-Do, is well-named.
Broke down the techniques employed by Drive-By Truckers, the band's music shouldn't really work well at all. Their signature sound consists of massed guitars, drums, and keyboards that owe a lot to 70s hard rock bands such as Lynyrd Skynyrd, the Marshall Tucker Band, and Black Oak Arkansas. The vocals wouldn't sound the way they do had Bob Dylan or the band not existed. The lyrics tend toward fiction, stories, the kind of stuff that usually works better on the printed page. Yet put them together with the kind of pitiless precision and gleeful tendency to turn every downer into a musical rave-up, and you've got yet another entry in what has become a really impressive body of work.
It was as open and shut as anything I had seen. It was a pillar of town, its reputation was clean. It was right before Easter in the first week of spring. Show up for service that Wednesday night. The congregation knew something weren't right. Blood on the bed when they opened the door. The preacher was dead on the bedroom floor. And everyone knew there had to be some outside thing that made this happen. Because they sang.
That's from The Wig He Made Her Wear, Patterson Hood's latest addition to the murder ballad tradition, updated to include Amber Alerts. It's the story of a small-town preacher shot dead by his wife because of the humiliating sexual peccadilloes he foisted upon her over a long period of time. The rumbling music behind the folksy recitation of degradation carries all of the foreboding and menace. The tension between Hood's calm detailing and the craggy guitar lines transform the song into a crime novel. At other times on this album, guitarist Mike Cooley relieves Hood with a slightly lighter bit of boogie-inflected country rock That's really only chipper until you listen closely to the words.
Kim said, Jim, you better get yourself up off of that raggedy couch. I'm too pretty to work and I'm tired of you uglying up my house. Jimmy said, baby, the guys at the top are doing bad as the guys on the street. Kim said, the guys at the top ain't about to be paying alimony to me. Said, go downtown, see what you can find. Put your face in someone's that ain't mine. Looks like them unemployment blues are wearing out your house shoes. Baby left when your boots came untied.
Drive-by truckers are chroniclers of smallness, small town life, lives crushed by small tragedies or rewarded by small kindnesses, kindness closed off by failures that go unnoticed by anyone except the people involved. On this song, called It's Gonna Be I Told You So, the band sets a small argument, the way one person in a squabble needs to have the other person acknowledge that he or she is right, against a soaring rush of melody. Ultimately, drive-by truckers are doing something common on certain TV shows and many independent films, but is increasingly rare in pop music. Celebrating losers, people in trouble, people who feel trapped. That such subjects used to be more prevalent in music is one reason why the truckers can sound like throwbacks. It's also what makes them sound so head-clearingly refreshing. They do it by making a big to-do about small but crucial things in life.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed The Big To-Do by Drive-By Truckers. Coming up, David Edelstein on the latest 3D blockbuster, Clash of the Titans. This is Fresh Air. Clash of the Titans is a remake of a 1981 epic remembered for its high-toned cast, which included Laurence Olivier as Zeus. The new film is in 3D and stars Avatar's Sam Worthington as Perseus, Liam Neeson as his father Zeus, and Ralph Fiennes as the malevolent god of the underworld Hades. Critic David Edelstein has seen both versions and has these thoughts.
Clash of the Titans makes a good case study in what's wrong with the Hollywood blockbuster mentality. Let's start by saying it's not a train wreck. A train wreck would be more entertaining. Honest craftsmen toiled to give it life. Accomplished actors clearly worked hard to conceal their boredom. Although the film was not conceived or shot to be seen in 3D, the Avatar box office blowout made it a suitable candidate for a quickie conversion. Advance sales have been through the roof. As I speak, fanboys are lined up for their new dose of spectacle. Now, there's no shame in loving spectacle. In the Poetics, Aristotle recognized it as an important component of drama, although much further down the list than plot, characters, and dialogue. But Aristotle never saw Avatar. Spectacle in movies goes a long way. We crave amazement. I certainly did when I lined up for the original 1981 Clash of the Titans back in the day. Here was my favorite actor, Lord Laurence Olivier, and he was in a movie with giant monsters. Giant monsters made by Ray Harryhausen, the stop-motion heir to King Kong FX master Willis O'Brien, the man behind The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, and Jason and the Argonauts. What could go wrong? Everything. Although I smile as I remember its truly mythic tackiness. The original Clash of the Titans rests on the tragic comic conceit at the heart of many Greek myths, that the seemingly random and often cruel fates of men, women, and nations can only be explained by gods and goddesses fighting among themselves like spoiled rich children with too much power. That meant Olivier's randy, petulant Zeus bickered with Maggie Smith's Thetis on Olympus, while down below, the kids they'd each conceived with mortals got constantly upended. The new Clash, though, is a humdrum revenge saga. Zeus's son with a mortal woman, Perseus, played by Avatar's Sam Worthington, is out to get Rafe Fiennes' Hades for killing his adopted family. That's why he looks really mad when Fiennes' giant god materializes out of swirling black smoke and in a plangent Shakespearean belch informs the insufficiently reverent Greek king he's going to unleash his deadliest monster, the Kraken. Up in Olympus, Liam Neeson's Zeus looks vexed but sad. He loves his little humans, but they're so unruly that he agrees with his brother Hades about calling forth the Kraken. But Perseus, his demigod son, is down there. What's a god to do?
You heard the witch's prophecy. You will not defeat the Kraken, much less Hades. If you continue this journey, you will die, and Argos will still fall.
You're so sure why you're here?
To offer you sanctuary. Your blood is mine, Perseus, and that makes you a god. It's time you came to Olympus and started living like one.
I'd rather die in the mud with those men than live forever as a god.
You foolish boy. Man's entire existence is a gift of my grace.
Somebody created man. You don't know much about us. We live. We fight. And we die. For each other. Not for you. Tell Hades I'll see him soon.
I will not make this offer again.
Good. Because I'd hate to refuse you twice.
Apart from Neeson's haggard majesty, there isn't a whisper of feeling in Clash of the Titans. Beefy Sam Worthington is too old and too seasoned doing battle with effects to make a compellingly youthful warrior, and a Chewbacca-esque sidekick doesn't make him any more like Luke Skywalker. The computer-generated monsters? They're okay. I especially liked the three hairy witches who share one eye. But the giant crab thingies don't have the rickety charm of Harryhausen's stop-motion work. Medusa is a supermodel's head on top of a giant serpent's body. She'd be much scarier if she were simpler. The Kraken, when it emerges, looks like a humongous octopus with the head of a snapping turtle. Somewhere, the reigning CGI Hellspawn champion, Lord of the Rings Balrog, is laughing its butt off. Here's the most interesting thing about Clash of the Titans. In the middle, I took off my 3D glasses, and even though it was slightly blurry, it was much more involving. Director Louis Leterrier knows how to use the wide screen to bring out the primordial beauty of the rocky desert landscapes, which are real. With those glasses on, though, They and everything in them look like one of those pop-out greeting cards. The trendy technology, the trendy revenge formula, the miscasting of a new big star, it all works against the movie. The dirty secret about the gods who call the shots in Hollywood is that they're boring.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can watch scenes from Clash of the Titans on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of digital media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies. Here's Blossom Deary.
They say it's spring. This feeling light as a feather. They say this thing, this magic we share together, came with the weather too. They say it's May that's made me daft as a daisy. It's May, they say, that gave the whole world this crazy, heavenly, hazy hue. I'm a lark on the wing. I'm the spark of a firefly's fling. Yet to me, this must be something more than a seasonal thing. Could it be spring? Those bells that I can hear ringing, it may be spring. But when the robin stops singing, you're what I'm clinging to.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Wiley, publisher of Hero of the Pacific, The Life of Marine Legend John Vassalone, available in bookstores and online. From the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And from LendingTree, committed to helping people control their financial destiny with innovative tools and personalized advice at LendingTree.com. This is NPR.
The creator of the HBO series The Wire, David Simon, teamed up with writer Eric Overmyer to create a new HBO series called Tremé. It's set in New Orleans 3 months after Katrina. The show premieres April 11th. On the next Fresh Air, our postponed interview with Simon and Overmyer. Join us.